Welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And my name is Sebastian, and I have COVID.
Yep. So we are recording this socially distanced via two completely separate houses to make sure we get the show out to everyone. And we also socially distanced watched Eurovision yesterday, so we will be diving into that very soon as well. But before we get to that, I wanted to share with you some utterly fantastically hilarious news. And that is that a grand theft has been solved.
Is it 100,000 liters of maple syrup?
No, not that grand theft. But if you were trying to figure it out, all you need to do is close your eyes, tap your heels three times.
Okay.
And think of what was stolen.
Did somebody steal Judy Garland's shoes from the shoe museum?
Somebody did. Yes. In 2005, somebody stole Judy Garland's shoes from the museum. It was a travesty. Anyway, they got recovered. So it was, they found them in 2018. Now, if you remember correctly, we joked about the fact that they were stolen and then discovered in 2018. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, I don't know if you recall, but back in 2018, where they recovered the pilfered shoes, they didn't, there was no arrests. Nobody was sent to prison for it. Mm-hmm. Well, that is until just last week, where a local 76-year-old man has now been arrested for effectively stealing, because he did. They were stolen for many years. The ruby slippers from the Wizard of Oz. From the museum at Grand Rapids, Minnesota. So yeah, he was arrested. What is this now? 4 or 5 years after the shoes were recovered, and almost 20 years after the crime took place itself.
And why does it say why it took so long? Or is it just hard to get evidence together or hard to make a case?
I think they were working on this case and other pieces of art that were stolen for quite a while. He was summoned just recently. Apparently, he refused to speak to the media, saying, "I have to get to court." And that was his only comment. So I'm like, you know what? That's a fair comment.
Enough. Guy is prompt, on time. Got a lot of respect for that. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, did you know? Are you keeping up with the who do we boycott this week? Outrage.
Well, if it has anything to do with food, I may have to ignore it because, as you know, everything tastes like either hairspray, soap, or rotting fish to me right now. There's a few things like bananas that just taste like bananas. What else have I? Yeah, last night I discovered the first thing that tastes better now that I have COVID mouth is alcoholic apple cider tastes twice as good now. Nice. Pizza just tastes like pizza, so you better bet it's pizza time for the next couple weeks. But I don't know. What's the latest boycott?
So apparently people were outraged that the new Pride collection released by Adidas, including a their Let Love Be Your Legacy collection, which was released on their website, features a large number of models wearing a whole range of different pieces of clothing, some of which are unisex, some of which are not. Mm-hmm. And people are outraged for what appears to be a man is wearing a unitard-type swimwear. That you would take a bikini, not a bikini, the other one.
A
that
One
you would
Piece?
often see on, sorry, what?
A One Piece?
That's the one. That's the one I was looking for. I was like, there is a phrase for it. You can tell I'm a gay man. Forgot what a One Piece was called.
Gay man doesn't know what an article of women's clothing's called. Another man knows exactly what it is immediately.
Yes,
They kind of both check out,
exactly.
but yeah.
So anyway, there is what is, by outrage, what appears to be a man is wearing a One Piece, and now we are collectively urged to boycott Adidas. Now, what Adidas and anyone with two eyeballs have also pointed out is that the One Piece is also on what evidently appears to be a woman, also on their website. So it is they're just promoting people wearing their clothes. So I think, let me just check my notes here. Clothing company urges people to wear clothes by putting clothes on people. I think we've captured it. I think that was the gist of outraged customers. I've got it.
Well, also bear in mind that in many parts of Europe, like we don't really have this association in North America, but in parts of Europe, articles of clothing are associated with street and gang culture. So hoodies, like just calling somebody a hoodie is a slang term that means that they are a low-level crime member, a petty criminal in parts of England. And I know that in Northern Europe and Eastern Europe, Adidas has this association with, chav culture and street culture. So it has, and it was appropriated, I guess you could say, not appropriated. It was developed over time. Adidas never pushed that. It was just, street culture kind of developed its own association with the tracksuit. So it's kind of like they already have their own internal symbolism with masculinity and the tracksuit that I might be reading into too much, but I know it's a thing. It is a thing. So yeah, I don't know. The boycott is probably not going to go too far though, because those three stripes are iconic. And if you're the sort of person to pay $200 for an Adidas tracksuit, you're going to pay your $200 for that Adidas tracksuit. You're not going to
Well,
boycott.
that's exactly. A lot of people are like, look, if someone's paying $70 for a pride swimsuit, the fact that there is a photo with what may be a man, maybe wearing it, I don't think that's going to put me off of my purchasing decision. You know what I mean? Clothing company tries to sell clothes. We need to be less shocked by these things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. It that's it. Dot dot dot. It is what it is. People, it's harder than one ad campaign to break a culture's love of something. So, the association in hip hop culture with like Jordans, for example, that might be a bit dated, but still, the association with certain shoes, it's part of it. It's going to take more than one ad campaign to break that. It's going to take quite some time. Actually, they ran into that a couple of years ago where people tried to boycott some shoe company, Reebok or something, I can't remember, but everyone was like, yeah, they're on sale now, great. Like it didn't really work.
Absolutely. So we watched, along with many others, actually, I won't tell you this much. Eurovision was the most watched Eurovision in, I think, its entire broadcast history. The number of people who watched this one is more than any of the other ones. To be honest, as far we hope that if this is of interest to you, that you go back and watch it. But if not, we'll give you a glorious recap in the way that only we can. And honestly, if you're looking to spend your time, you've got 4 hours to kill, who, because everyone has that. I'd recommend 2016. I don't know, it's
Oh, yeah.
2023 was okay. It was very middle of the road for a Eurovision, very middle of the road.
And you don't really need 4 hours. You need 3 hours. You need 2 hours to watch all the music. Skip hour three, and then hour four is when the exciting judges start rolling in. When the points, when the P's start getting counted up. Because there's always that one upset when they start counting the audience vote, where there's somebody at the bottom, and then they get 379 points or whatever from the viewing public, and they just shoot up and win. So that kind of thing that can happen, that's probably the most exciting part.
The first half is the music competition. The points half is the competition between the jury and everyone
And
else.
everyone
You know,
else.
it's the It really is the national juries versus everyone with a cell phone.
Yeah,
that's how it breaks down. Well, look, we had a fantastic time watching some of it. I was amused. Like every Eurovision, there are some iconic things that are consistent. The tiny 40-second montages is you know definitely you're always going to get them because they need time to change the stage. So music,
yeah, yeah.
They perform, and then there's a 40-second montage of just, you know, it's almost like a picture slideshow, and then you're into the next performance.
Usually beautiful crane shots or these days swooping drone shots of, you know, a castle in Croatia, a river in Moldova, you know, a public park in Germany. It's always these beautiful shots of the beautiful parts of the country. Never the garbage dump, you know, or a
refinery. It was getting there. I think they were stretching with this one. So it would start off with a beautiful aerial drone shot of some location in Turkey. You have to guess what the category is. Is the category bridges, libraries, a pond?
Passes. There's mazes was one of them.
Rooftops was a whole category.
Okay.
The rooftop one, that was definitely my favorite. And then it would show a rooftop in Ukraine, a rooftop in London, and then a rooftop in Liverpool, and then a rooftop somewhere, whatever the country is that's competing.
I think it was Greece they did the rooftops.
Sorry?
I think it was Greece. They are known for having big, beautiful blue roofs, though.
Oh, yeah. My favorite one was the amphitheaters. And then it was like Israel.
There was that cool one in Cornwall. I didn't know that existed. It was like right built into the ocean. It was fantastic.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. But anyway, so what about these montages?
Well, I don't know. They felt a little contrived. They very much felt like they were designed by an advertising agency. At the end of it, I'm like, is this where I buy travel insurance or an umbrella? Like, it's telling me to do something with a yellow umbrella. I'm close. They were very good nondescript ads for, you know, bridges and rooftops.
The good ones, yeah. Well, I mean, the reason why countries pay into this, why national broadcasters pay into this, because it is advertising for travel. So that is their little spot to do travel. But there's a few of them, like Italy, where they really focused really hard on, like, look at us, we have an attractive singer. And you're like, yeah, but you're Italy. Like, show us cool pictures of Rome. And it's like, nope, here's more pictures of the guy who's going to sing.
Not a fan of Italy. I think Jess put it best as Italian James Blunt. I think that was how she captured that particular performance.
Every year, at least one country tries for the overdramatic ballad, and occasionally they win. But yeah, this year it was Italy's turn.
There was a lot more this year of countries being like, I'm Czech. I'm going to just speak in Czech, and, you know, my audience will understand it. You can choose to whether or not you want to understand it.
That's like,
the Portuguese was saucy. It was spicy. It was unapologetically Portuguese. That one, I think, it was fantastic. And then I think that dovetailed beautifully to Spain.
Yes.
Where you thought it was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez potentially
somebody else. No, what I liked about Spain, okay, so the thing that I like about Eurovision is exactly what you're talking about. When countries mix their own ethnic sounds in with modern pop music, that's one of the reasons why Georgia and Azerbaijan are actually often my favorite acts of the year, because they do really interesting stuff with melodies. This year I really like Spain because it sounded like experimental future flamenco. And there was just something about it that really appealed to me. It was a really interesting musical sound. They scored really poorly, but from a musical point of view, I thought it was probably the most interesting thing all year. It really caught my ear as being something weird and different.
Well, we're going to jump into that. We're going to jump into Blanco Paloma, which was the Spanish entry. I have here in my notes from yesterday, high concept experimental flamenco. And I think you summed that up beautifully as well.
Yes.
All right. We will be back just after this. and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we just earlier, you had Blanco Palomas, yeah, from Spain. That was the high concept experimental flamenco, I believe. But following that was not actually a Eurovision entry by any of the artists. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to kind of take the conversation now is to how the Eurovision tried to balance the Ukraine, the Liverpool hosts, and it's the fact that it's Eurovision into one cohesive thing. So I played You Spin Me Round Like a Record, the Netta cover, a Netta Israeli winner of Eurovision, fantastic musician. But they did this for a few different ones. There were a few different classic songs out of Liverpool that had Eurovision covers. I think it was
Imagine by
Looking Back, I Turn to You.
Yep, by Mel C. Imagine by John Lennon. They did little musical stings here and there to famous British groups. Like they did.
I thought I heard Ace of Base at one point.
No. There's just a band that sounded exactly like Ace of Base. Who forgot that Ace of Base is Swedish. There's a band called Sexpress that they played. They also had Blur. They played Blur and Chemical Brothers and the Eurythmics. And they also
it
made
was
a reference.
Eurythmics, that's what it was.
They made a reference to Eric Clapton's Layla at one point in time as well. So for me, the most frustrating thing is that I would say that somewhere between 10% and 20% of the 20th century's best music comes out of England. You know, you got yourself the Beatles, you got Eric Clapton, you've got Radiohead, you've got all these wonderful, wonderful, open-minded experimental musicians pushing things forward. David Bowie, for example, Mick Jagger. And then you see what England sends to Eurovision and you're just like, what are you doing? Yeah. It is so bizarre. And Eurovision was just loaded with all these reminders of better musicians after years of people saying, just send Adele. Adele.
I think this was almost like a Eurovision by colors, like by numbers. It was just didn't quite add. It didn't have the spontaneity and creativity that I think allows Eurovision to succeed so well.
Yeah, it didn't have that magic.
The canned bits felt very mechanical and jokes were just not landing, you know, and it was a little contrived at some points. Mm-hmm. But Hannah Waddingham did a fantastic job. I thought she was fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, and I felt like this particular Eurovision was like, okay, we need to have an incredible Ukrainian music montage for 7 minutes, and then we must do something Liverpool related for 7 minutes, and then we need to do something else. And it's, you know, it just felt much like it was designed by a very large committee. That seemed to be the sense I was getting from it. What about you?
I mean, it was developed largely by the BBC, so it.
So, like I said, designed by a large committee. it was lacking some of the soul and creativity that you'd hope to see in what is the campest music competition on the planet. You know, like there's a certain degree of queerness that needs to happen there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, another way of putting it is that there was the creative person in the room, and then the committee took their creative ideas and did not do a good job of applying them.
No. Well, there was different things came up. Like we saw news reports that the gay village in Liverpool has not only had a massive post-pandemic recovery because of Eurovision going there, but the tourism on either side of those, you know, large music event has done wonders as well. Mm. Like it's really sort of raised the profile, put it more on the map as a queer cultural space. Mm-hmm. So this is good for Liverpool's LGBTQ residents and businesses. We also saw that
the opposite effect of the Olympics, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And then we also saw that in Liverpool, they had, I think it was Nelson, giant statue of Nelson. Mm-hmm. And they sandbagged it. They covered it with sandbags in the same way that a lot of the major monuments in the Ukraine are sandbagged.
Oh. So
as people are there for the Eurovision, some of these major landmarks in Liverpool are dressed in a way to kind of draw that connection with Ukraine. So I thought, you know, and that's something that you're not going to see on the Eurovision, but I thought it was a really respectful way of thinking about the people who are physically there.
Symbolism.
You know? Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, geez. All right. Well, let's keep going, shall we? So definitely a lot of really interesting music choices. There were a few that just sound like, well, a travel sequence in a Disney movie. Mm-hmm. There was definitely a couple that fit that bill.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Travel montage. Yes. Classic go-to, you know.
There was also your annual confused act. Like, there was one group that was like, what was it? It was like sci-fi, anime, boy band. It was vampire, kind of this weird, I think it was Croatia. It was just this weird, confused mash of visual non-cues failing to go together. And Germany as well, which Germany had
blood
that...
and glitter. They did the worst. I love that song. But mm-hmm. Yeah, they had 5 points. They did terribly.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the only note I have from Germany was somebody in the room said, poor Toronto, because I had inflicted this song on them. Like, mm-hmm. they were terrified on behalf of our audience. Well, these things happen. But one of the things that I think is what makes Eurovision is the really campy solutions. And we've got two songs lined up coming up next. The first is Who the Hell is Edgar, who is the Austria submission to Eurovision. And then we are following that with Finland's Cha-Cha-Cha.
Yes.
So the Finnish submission to Eurovision. Now, I think Who the Hell is Edgar is going to be one of those earworms that stick with you. The way that Måneskin didn't necessarily, oh, they did win, but they really got a lot of success from some of their other earworms. But I don't know, what do you think of Who the Hell is Edgar and the Cha-Cha-Cha?
Well, Cha-Cha-Cha was the audience favorite. You could see the hosts were visibly upset by the fact that the audience kept cheering Cha-Cha-Cha. Cha-Cha-Cha, and it was they had by far the largest audience vote, and it was a landslide in terms of who the audience liked best. It was just confusing and goofy, and it was it pop music, was it heavy metal, what was it? It was just this confused musical mess, but the guy who was singing was so sincere and having so much fun that you were on board with it.
Absolutely.
I definitely recommend everybody look up Cha-Cha-Cha because it's just so weird. And I honestly, it was the authenticity and sincerity of the performance of just these people love being here and they're having a great time and they're taking you down with them. And I think I think that's the number one thing that really made them flourish.
What I've got here in my notes is it's giving 90s Europe. Very 90s Europe.
Okay.
And also, it's giving Eurovision. You know what I mean? It is, Cha-Cha-Cha was this year's peak Eurovision song.
Yes.
And you can't, how do you distill what is a Eurovision song? It has a certain je ne sais quoi. It's campy. It's over the top. Mm-hmm. It's musically interesting. And it's not what everyone would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that I think is, you know, how you would spin it into a bottle. Anyway, this is Who the Hell is Edgar by Teja and Selena, and then we are following that off with Kjarisha's Cha-Cha-Cha, the Finnish entry.